Hello and welcome to the Gold Goats and Guns podcast for January 23rd, 2023. My name is Tom Luongo and we have a lot to talk about. Today, I get to finish off the home and home. If you guys are hockey fans, you know exactly what I'm talking about with the great James Dellingpole, who I was on his show about 2 weeks ago now. We had a lovely time. And, we got done with that one. I said, well, James, you were gracious and invited me onto your show. I get to be gracious, which I'm not particularly good at, and invite you back onto my show. So, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Tom. I really appreciate the graciousness. I mean, I don't often go on people's shows because I'm just not because I'm sure everyone wants me, but I'm so flaky. The thing I really enjoy about podcasts is just sitting down and chatting to a kindred spirit. And really, you asked me what I wanted to talk about today. Mm. I really don't care. I can talk about stuff. I can talk about anything, pretty much. And I don't prepare for my podcasts. Mm. I just like a good conversation. So we're going to have one today.
Right. It's funny you mentioned that, like, because we ran into that, right? When we were trying to schedule my being on your show, it kind of fell through a couple of times because things happen. And I know it was really funny because it was, trying to schedule with your assistant, who was very apologetic and everything. I'm like, dude, I get it. I can't tell you how many times I've overscheduled myself or literally forgotten on the morning. As a matter of fact, I have one sitting here on my desk this morning. I got up this morning knowing that I had to do this one. And then I got a DM from somebody else that, are we still good for noon? I'm like, I guess we are. So,
yeah. And also, I've got priorities, Tom. I've realized, as we approach the fast approach, the end of the world, I think it's really important to prioritize.
Right.
And the thing that I prioritize most in my life is being on a horse. I really like being on a horse. And if there's any opportunity to be on a horse, especially galloping fast and jumping over hedges, then that's what I want to be doing. And so podcasts, take a second place to that.
Fair enough. And that's that is absolutely something in this life that should take a second, should take a priority over, ranting into a microphone, which we all do all the time. I don't ride. My wife did when she was younger. And one of the things that sits on my brain is that I've made many promises to her over the years. And one of them is, travel. And the second one is getting her a horse, and never gotten her a horse. Did get her the new car that I figured out about 20 years ago. Those are the three promises I made for her. She's a poor woman, but, I've gotten her.
You're like a dad that promises his daughter a pony and never quite delivers. Now you've moved to the wife horse stage. Yeah.
Yeah. But then again, at the same time, she now, her trainer lives just up the road and has horses. So I don't really need to do that. So, and I don't have the land for a horse anyway. And she knows that as well as I do, but it's just one of those things. It's just one of those things I like to bring up every once in a while. So, because my wife does adore horses. All right. Well, it's funny. After we last chatted, I thought about this, and like you, I don't generally prep these very much unless the guest really has something they absolutely want to talk about. And, I thought, well, what am I going to talk to James about? And then this morning I was popping through the headline space, and I noted that, Jeremy Clarkson's getting canceled over his crack about Meghan Markle. And, it's funny. Clarkson is one of my favorites. I don't know about you, but I just find Clarkson, I've always been a huge fan of Top Gear. Love what they do over at Amazon. And I just always found Clarkson to be that, vaguely un-PC ape that just goes around and does his thing and, gets himself in trouble, but does so, I think, sometimes on purpose. And then, and then uses that to build a bigger brand for himself. And I find that I don't have any problem with that whatsoever. But the situation with him and Amazon and Meghan Markle is, I think, a little different than what's happened to him in the past. What do you think about that?
Yeah, my take on Clarkson is probably going to be different now than it would have been, say, 3 years ago. I mean, I don't know whether you make the distinction between normies and non-normies, people who are down the rabbit hole and not.
Yeah.
But I used to... when I was a sort of mainstream media journalist, I could have written endless think pieces on the genius of Jeremy Clarkson. And mm-hmm. I love Top Gear.
Right.
I love his Amazon show isn't quite as good, I don't think, as Top Gear. But it's boys having fun, boys being politically incorrect, boys enjoying, petrol sniffing and stuff and doing doing proper boysy things. Mm-hmm. I've since come to understand better how the guy rolls. I'm a great admirer of his. I like the fact that he did a great program about farming. Did you see that?
Oh, that the Clarkson's Farm was brilliant.
Clarkson's Farm was utterly fantastic. I think I did the power of good. I think to the hard pressed farming industry, which is one of the industries which they
agreed,
the powers that be or whatever, want to close down. I mean, see mm-hmm. Ice Age Farmer on this and
oh, absolutely, yeah.
It's part of the dark satanic plan. They want us to, they feed us bugs to deny us access to meat and so yeah. I'm a great admirer of farmers and he did them a lot of favors.
Absolutely.
The thing about Clarkson is that he knows how to play the game. And I suppose that the Meghan Markle thing is an exception to this because it seems like he's pushed it too far.
Right.
Although really, what did he do? He just said a lot of sentient beings think about Meghan Markle. I mean, she's poison.
Yes.
That's a given. But right. Whereas once I used to think, well, used to be quite interested in the antics of the royal family. Now I realize that it is just theatre designed to keep the normies in place, to keep right. them fixed, distracted on this distraction, yes. while meanwhile in the real world the dark forces take away our lands, take away our freedoms, do all this stuff, and the normies are just going, oh, the royal family did this. Oh, I'm Team Harry, or I'm not Team Harry, or what? It's all distraction.
Of course.
So I'm digressing here because I'm moving on from Clarkson to the royal family. Sure. Clarkson, I've watched him with a sort of mixture of admiration and mild contempt, increasing contempt, because he, for example, on the environment, you know, which is of course another part of the scam. You know that Clarkson cannot possibly believe that. Due to man's selfishness and greed and refusal to amend his selfish carbon-guzzling lifestyle, we are destroying the planet. It's all our fault. Therefore, we've got to carpet the landscape with bat-chomping, bird-slicing eco-crucifixes. Right. We've got to put on hair shirts. We've got to do it. He cannot believe this stuff. And yet, occasionally, he will make a nod, either in his articles or on his TV programs,
sure.
to this notion, this demonstrably false notion. Mm-hmm. I can't, as somebody who was once described as a kamikaze conservative, although I wouldn't even call myself a conservative anymore, I don't believe in the left-right divide. Nevertheless, as somebody who really does not give a toss about whether or not he's cancelled, the only thing I give a toss about is my freedom to tell the truth at whatever personal cost.
Right.
I'm not looking at Clarkson and going, you are a hero.
Right.
I'm going, I wanted you in the foxhole next to me, holding the perimeter at Bastogne. Mm-hmm. And instead I've looked to my right and I've seen that your foxhole is empty mm-hmm. when the Germans started attacking. That's where I feel with Clarkson.
Yeah.
Entertaining, but not a hero.
Yeah, no, I mostly feel the same way. It's funny, the latest article that he put out, or the latest, his scathing response now, I saw it on Zero Hedge this morning, which is why I finally, you know, the story actually, I mean, I saw the original thing with him and Meghan Markle. I didn't think it was anything of it. I'm like, this is typical. And then all of a sudden, like 2 months later or a month and a half later, I'm like, Clarkson's getting canceled over that? Are you kidding? And he didn't roll it off. And I saw him apologize and I'm like, mistake number one. Then he apologized again. Mistake number two. Clearly was getting pressure from Amazon about this. And now Amazon's going to cancel him anyway. Going to, you know, cancel the Grand Tour. And but again, then there's always the question of when he left Top Gear, did he pick that fight in order to get out of Top Gear because the BBC wasn't paying them what they were worth? And there were, and I'm sure that they had offers on the table from people like Amazon. There were 5, 6, 7 times what they were being paid. So there's, you know, with Clarkson, there's always a bit of theater that you're never quite sure about. And fair enough, dude. Like, you know, Top Gear was the biggest thing in the freaking world. And working for the BBC sucks. Like, fuck those guys. If you can get 7 times the amount of money out of Amazon, do it. Especially with totally. That guy chain smokes. He's going to be dead soon anyway. But
it's, well, I'm not sure that I believe that actually smoking. I've reached the stage, Tom, where I think that whatever they tell us most forcefully is also the least true thing. So they tell us that vaccines are the greatest miracle in medicine. I think, no, they're toxic. They say smoking is bad for you. I'm thinking, maybe I should take up smoking again. But that is
well, all I'm going to say is I actually don't even look at the smoking. I look at Clarkson's belly. I look at James May's belly and I'm going, you guys are prime candidates for Widowmaker, and you know, and that's really where I'm more worried about them. I look at both of them going, oh, look, they're type the skin, the sallow skin, everything else is type 2 diabetes. And like they're walking type 2 diabetes. And then if Clarkson still smokes on top of it, I'm like, oh, Jesus.
Oh, totally. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I know these people. I meet them at parties and things. Mm-hmm. I actually met Clarkson at a party, I think last year.
Oh, wow.
And I saw him across the room, and I was doing that. I was playing that game, which we all play, where, yeah, I know you think you're a really famous person, but I'm not going to acknowledge you at all. I'm not going to be impressed by you, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And actually, the weird thing was that while I was studiously ignoring him, he ignored all the other people in the room and came up to me and started a conversation with me. And the reason was that I'd written a review of Clarkson's Farm in the Spectator, something else I'd reviewed, and he wanted to talk to me. But no, I hadn't reviewed his own program. That would have been a bit obsessive on his part.
Right.
I'd reviewed something else, and he'd obviously read the review and wanted to quit. Maybe he wanted to butter me up, knowing that in the future I might write a review of another of his programs, which right. I did, right. Clarkson's Farm, and I loved it. Anyway, going back to your point about theatre. I think that anyone on a certain level of celebrity is part of the bread and circuses that the powers that be used to distract us from what's really going down in the world. I think you and I are on the kind of the maximum level of fame that you can achieve without selling your soul. Anyone on the level above us, you know, we're talking about Joe Rogan, you know, the Ben Shapiro sort of fake conservative scam, you know, the Stephen Crowder incident where he's revealed the contract that they sign. And it's basically a contract signed in blood with the devil. They have sold their soul in return for millions of dollars, which we'd all like, but would we like those $1 million if it was on condition that we would never offend the ADL? If we lost social media popularity, that therefore we'd lose 50% or whatever it is of our earnings? I would rather live in relative penury than strike that deal with the devil. I studied English literature at Oxford, you know, so I hung out with the establishment. I'm really, really clever, okay? Mm-hmm. And I read lots of fancy books like Dr. Faustus by Christopher Marlowe. Mm-hmm. I know what happens when you sell your soul to the devil.
Yep.
It doesn't end well. You get some cool stuff in the beginning, but at the end, it turns out badly. I think going back to Clarkson, I love the man in many ways, but I can't respect the deal he's made. I can't respect the deal that any celebrities make because it is...
Of course.
They sacrifice the ability to tell the truth for filthy lucre.
Yeah, there it is. Agreed. And you know, it's just I think for all of us, and this is a general point that we get. It doesn't matter who we're talking about. I can, you know, it doesn't matter if we're talking about Clarkson or we're talking about a politician or anybody. Everybody at some realize that everyone has a certain amount of this in their public persona, and it's our job to always remind ourselves of that and then see the limits of what their value to us is. That's it. You know, it doesn't matter who it is. And I expect everybody to hold my feet to the fire at every point. And believe me, even when I was a nobody, people were holding my feet to the fire thinking I was some, you know, because that's what they do. Yeah. You know, as you come up through this process, it is what it is. And I know that you've been through it. We've all been, we're all going to go through it. I'm going to do my best, like everything else, to continue to say, this is the way it's going to be. When I was on your show, you asked me about the Ghazari Mafia, and I just said, look, I don't want to talk about it. Why? Because I like my platform too much. I don't consider that a deal with the devil. I just consider that the right thing to do if I want. I have to make the – because everybody has to make the value choice of where can you do good? Where is it – you know, where is it – you know, where can you not do good? And if you can do more – if you can, in my position at this point, I can do a lot more good here than I can over here. So I'll leave that to the other people, and I will take care of what I can take care of. And understand that, because if you have any value for the work you do at all, right? You're thinking of yourself personally, then if you approach it from that perspective, then you won't sell your soul. You'll just know what you can avoid. And then when someone comes to you with an extractive friggin' contract, like the one that Crowder was, you know, Crowder was LARPing there a little bit. You think Crowder was ever going to sign that contract? That was contract that he presented was exactly, well, that's the one that they were, that the Daily Wire, Ben Shapiro would turn to me and say, hey, how about this one? And I'd be like, no. I wouldn't sign that contract, or any other up and coming YouTuber would have, you know, signed that. Like, but Crowder was doing the right thing in exposing, this is not a contract you want to sign, right? This is nothing close to what a contract you want to sign. That's an opening offer. That offer sucks. Don't you dare even think about it, because then they have you and they own you and you're done. And so just understand that. And I have a partner who is very, very concerned about my inability to say no, for example, right? And I value him.
It's hard
for all of that. Yeah, of course it is. When you've got nothing, yeah, it's hard. Of course it is.
Yeah. I didn't listen to you saying about the Kazarian mafia and think, mm-hmm, what a total cuck.
Right.
I think obviously there are people out there who want to cancel us at every opportunity, and they will always find an excuse. And you were right, by the way, earlier on, saying you never, ever, ever fucking apologize. Never, ever, 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 ever do you apologize. Because it's like sharks. What they're after is a bit of blood. And once they scent blood, they'll just come for more. They won't go, oh, well, he's apologized now.
I missed all of that. So let me get an edit real quick. 8:23. That'd be about 28 minutes in. That's fine. Just wait.
Yeah, do that. No, I've got. Do you know what? I've got shitty Apple headphones. I think they.
It's fine. Something happened there, so it's no big deal. But just go back to, you know, like.
So never, ever, 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 ever. This is one of my mottos, by the way. Never, ever, 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 ever apologize. Why would you do that? Apart from else, what have you got to apologize for? I mean, Meghan Markle, she's just like the end. I mean, she's just, well, mind you, everyone in the entertainment industry is compromised. Is working for Satan, basically. And this, by the way, is my get out of jail free. Mm-hmm. There are lots of people who speculate on who it is that really runs the world. You know, who is the boss?
Right.
In video games, who would be Dr. Robotnik? The final one you've got to slay.
Right.
And it's a no brainer. It is Satan.
Mm-hmm.
Satan is controlling. He pulls all the strings, and the Bible is perfectly clear on this. You know, that Paul calls him the God of this world, because that's the deal. I mean, whether or not you believe in the Bible, that is the deal, and it spells it out. Right. That Satan, by God's permission, is essentially has been given the world as his satrapy, and you know,
and it's our job to figure out how best to resist that, and then find our best way through it.
Yeah. So I'm cool with that, but I don't like. The thing that really pisses me off on, you know, since going down the rabbit hole about 3 years ago, you could argue I was there before, because I mean, I read a book called Watermelons about the environmental movement, which is, I think, is how you first discovered me.
Yes.
And the environmental movement is a key chunk of this massive scam. You know, once you understand that they invented man-made climate change as a way of controlling us, of imprisoning us with their so-called renewable energy, which is not, it's unreliable energy. It's crony capitalism. It's rent seeking. It's nothing more than that. Doesn't save the planet, actually damages the planet.
Yes.
Because that's another thing about Satan, by the way, the whole concept of satanic inversion. Mm. So when you've got greenies telling you they're saving the planet, no, they're actually destroying the planet. Anyway, since my journey down the rabbit hole, I've come to realize that nothing should be off the menu. Nothing should be off the conversational menu. So, for example, I've encountered people who've looked into flat Earth, and they've decided that actually flat Earth is actually a thing. It's not just some crazy thing. They've examined the pros and cons, and they found out. And you get lots of other people who are down the rabbit hole who are fine on 9/11, fine on moon landing stuff, but say, we don't want to be hanging out with these crazy flat earthers because they're doing us a disservice. And I say, well, hang on a second. There must have been a stage in your life when you too believed in the paradigm, when you thought it was an absolute given that Neil Armstrong was the first man who landed on the moon. I mean, how could you doubt it when you saw President Nixon himself picking up his phone and speaking to the astronauts, et cetera, et cetera. Right. So you're telling me that now you're king of rules, you're king of the rules on which is an acceptable theory and which is not. I'm saying, look, let's hear it. Let's hear the evidence. Let's hear your argument. And let's not judge, because this is a crazy world. And it seems that it is not as it's presented to us.
Right. No, I it's funny. It's the same thing. I've engaged with flat earthers before. I've engaged with all sorts of people, and I don't have to be swayed by them. I'll give you a perfect example. Is the funny thing is, like, I say this all the time. You know, I don't know if you know the joke that, you know, what's the difference between a minarchist and an anarchist in libertarian circles? Well, about 2 years. Right. It's that.
Yeah.
Right, okay. It's the hang time between I can't really get myself out of believing in government, which is a consensual hallucination, just like everything else in this freaking world. Philip K. Dick was so right about almost everything. And then coming down to the going, no, really, Rothbard's right. It's really just, you know, it's really just a fundamental abrogation of all of our rights as people. And, you know, not saying that then maybe the necessary evil we have to live with here or there in our lives, but it should be the thing we eventually work towards and be willing to accept that way. That's when I describe myself as an anarchist at this point, that's where I am. When I describe myself as a libertarian, I'm just the guy on the path to realization of tyranny. That's it. As best I can, right?
I'm glad you mentioned the anarchism thing, because that is part of the conspiracy against us. What they do is whoever they are, capital right. T, they take words and they change their meaning.
Yes,
because they are liars, because they're ruled by the Prince of Lies. So they persuade everyone, pretty much, apart from you and me and a few others, that anarchists. They come up with these handy phrases like, okay, you believe in anarchy, do you? Why not go and live in Somalia? And Somalia is their paradigm of anarchy. Anarchy does not mean that. Anarchy just means without a state. It just means doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad thing.
Right. I mean, we're doing anarchy right now. I mean, this is the thing. I say this to people all the time. Like, everything where you and someone else interact without a third party prescribing the limits of whatever it is that you're doing, prescribing the terms of your interaction, that's an anarchic process. You are engaging in practical anarchy. Now, ask yourself, if it works there, can it work here? Well, you may not believe that we can need private roads or anything else and like all the rest of it. And I'm like, that's not what's important. What's important is that you embrace the idea of what anarchy actually is and what is not anarchy. Because then you can decide for yourself where the dividing line is in your conception of what a civil society looks like. And then we can have a conversation about where that line gets drawn, and we can move it or back and forth depending on the circumstance. It's one of the things when I was chatting with guys like Matt Arid and Alistair Crook and Joaquin Flores about geopolitics. And I did a whole series of podcasts to understand how China operates, like that. We have a set of rules here in the West. We have a system, right? And that system is colonialism and extractive colonialism for all intents and purposes. And it's at the and with the transaction being at the center of our system. Places like China, Iran, Russia, those are places that the system is subordinate to the society. And because of that, China can run with whatever system they want at that moment in time or for this period of history that's optimal to them and then change the system. China is still China. So that's why they can be Maoist and then Dengist and now Xiist, and they can be something else. And maybe in 20 years, they won't even nominally be communists anymore. They're just nominal communists today. They may even get rid of that and move on to a different system, because the society itself and their conception of what their society is and what their conception of what China is and their relationship to the state is far more important than the system under which they live. Here in the West, we're all about the system, and we've forgotten that the system is subordinate to the society and to the culture.
And no, totally.
I think that's part of what this whole thing about Clarkson getting, they use that to cancel people who are heretics to that system.
They do. They create out groups in order to demonstrate. It's a bit like the Cultural Revolution, actually, where you've got people, intellectuals, with wooden boards hanging from their neck, explaining that they. But
Clarkson is going through a struggle session right now, and he was too dumb to realize that he was going through it.
Yeah, I know. This is another part of the PSYOP. Of course, we've been persuaded that there is the totalitarian world of places like China and North Korea, and meanwhile we live in these things called liberal democracies. So I had this one of the things that most annoys me in the world, and I tell you, Tom, I've got a really long list.
Sure. Oh, really?
You wouldn't guess it, would you? One of the things that I'm sure you share this one. So. Yeah, I love traveling and I love staying in nice hotels and stuff. And you go to a hotel room and you try and get to sleep, and there are all these fucking lights, red lights glowing all over. I mean, for one thing, I do not want a TV in my hotel room, but that's not an option that you ever get given. They always have TV rooms. It's like having Big Brother there, whether you like him or not. But okay. The TV has always got a stupid red light that you cannot disconnect. Yeah. And whatever that's, whatever the high-pitched noises that TVs produce, you cannot turn that on. So already you've got electronic signals in your room.
Right.
You've also got these lights that have been positioned, night lights that you can't turn off unless you've remembered to, I mean, one should bring masking tape.
Right.
Duct tape, whatever, to a hotel, even a ritzy hotel, because that's the deal now. So somebody tweeted today something like, I'm staying in a hotel in Cadiz, this is my bedroom, and I can't sleep. And the photograph was of this green light on the ceiling, so you can't even drape a towel over it, because you can't drape a towel over a ceiling, which is what I normally do, you know, to cover all the lights. This person's night was being rendered, his holiday, his freedom, his enjoyment was being rendered hell by the regulations that insisted that some kind of, I don't know what the reason would be, but for his own safety, he had to have this stupid fucking green light in his bedroom. And so I tweeted out this photograph saying, you know, I'm with this guy totally. And somebody else tweeted out, yes, but what you've got to understand is that light is serving a function to preserve his. And I'm thinking, this is how we fail. We build our own prisons, to quote Catherine Austin Fitz. Mm-hmm. This is what we do all the time. Yeah. They create these rules, and instead of going, fuck this rule, we say, yeah, maybe there is a reason why we have to have these lights to keep us awake. You know, oh, it's to protect us. It's for our own good.
And just in case we wake up in the middle of the night and we're going to trip on our way to the fucking bathroom. Well, then that's my goddamn problem. Caveat emptor for you fucking ninnies. Like, it's just that simple. And like, again, no, it's purely about control. It's purely about ensuring that you're constantly stressed and they're in charge of, and they circumscribe your life at every moment of every day. You're absolutely right about that. Yeah. It's ridiculous. And I'm sitting here listening to this in horror. My eyes are bugging out of my head. I'm like, I just got back from spending a weekend, an evening in Orlando. And I don't sleep well in hotel rooms. I've always, just never have, but not because of the lights or anything else. It's just a matter of an uncomfortable
age, Tom. It's an age thing, apart from anything else. You know, you get to a certain age, you can only sleep in your own bed. There it is, with your own pillow.
Well, actually, it's getting better. I can actually almost get sleep in a hotel room now. When I was like 18 and tried to sleep, I could never sleep. I would just be there all night. It was crazy. And my daughter's got the same kind of weird anxiety about not sleeping in their own. Actually, the older I get, the more I can sleep anywhere. It's kind
oh,
of
really?
That's
good. Yeah. I'll tell you another of my bugbears while we're still on the subject of bugbears. So occasionally generous country folk will invite me to stay in their country houses. And you always get put in the guest bedroom, which has got their winter. Do you sleep under duvets in America?
No, I don't. I'm not sure what you guys duvet for me, please. So
a duvet is like this thing stuffed with feather, with down.
Oh no, we don't. Here in Florida, we have.
Oh, of course, I forget. You'd have a sort of single sheet, something like that. Yeah, okay. And you sleep under a mosquito net, right?
No, actually, it's not that bad. We actually keep the house really cold, and then like pile blankets on top of us in the summertime. But you know, it's not a lot of wool. Let's just.
Put well, it sounds like so. I really like to sleep in a cold room with the window open. And even in the depths of winter, I will sleep with the summer weight duvet on. They have different togs according to whether it's a winter weight or summer weight. And if I sleep at other people's houses, they've always got the winter duvet with its 13.5 tog, which is like for Arctic conditions. And you sort of, you get in there and think, oh, I feel oppressed. I feel like there's this weight on me. And then about half an hour later, if you've got to sleep, if you're lucky enough to go to sleep, you wake up and you think, I am so hot. I will not get a moment's sleep tonight. And then you have a choice. Do I sleep with no duvet and freeze my ass off completely? Or do I? Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'm just turning into a grumpy old man. It happens to us.
It's possible. It's actually funny. My wife at one point bought one of these 15-pound blankets. You know, it's just a weighted blanket, and she bought.
Yes, I've heard about these.
Yeah, and in order to try and get you to immobilize while you're sleeping and everything else, and she couldn't do it. She was starting to go through menopause, so she was having hot flashes. She couldn't use it. Mm. I got it. I'm like, oh, this thing's awesome. So on the nights where I don't fall asleep on the couch, not because I don't like my wife, but just simply because sometimes I just really like to sleep by myself, and it's a weird thing. As I get older, I find myself just not for any other reason. I just like to sleep on the couch. And I have a very comfortable couch as well. But when I do sleep in the bed and I really need a good night's sleep, oh no, I get underneath that thing and my wife keeps the room at, you know, 60 degrees or 62 degrees or whatever the hell it is. It's crazy. Yeah. And I just hibernate for 7 hours or 6 or 7 hours and then I'm good. And I wake up the next morning. I'm like, all right, let's attack the day and write 4,000 words before 10 o'clock. And those are usually my best days.
Maybe the Victorians had it right. I mean, didn't the sort of the husband and the wife have separate beds, and you sort of joined each other for a bit of nookie, and then retired back to your own.
Actually, what I've heard is that women sleep better when the man is in the bed because they feel safe, protected. And secure. But the men sleep better by themselves. So what I do, and I was telling my therapist, is like I have to go back and forth, and you know, like so I have to consciously make sure that I give I spend certain days a week there and other times indulge myself. And I just have to remind my wife, I'm like, it is nothing personal. It truly is just, there are some nights when I just need to be by myself. And this is my way of getting into my own headspace. And, you know, I'll give the world and her and my dog and everybody else all of my time. But then for those 5.5 to 6 hours of sleep that I sleep every night, sometimes I just need that to be mine. And
it's complicated being married, isn't it? I mean, we're just offering the listeners a tiny taste of the
31 years conflict. For us in February. We'll be married 31 years in February.
I'm wondering how. Do you know when we got married? We got married the day before Princess Diana was. I was about to say was murdered by MI5. Of course, I meant had her accident in the Paris Tunnel.
We got married right after Frank Zappa died. That's kind of I lost my dad and Frank Zappa, and then the next February, we needed to get married for tax reasons, and then it was just kind of stuck. And
it's funny that we date things according to these reference points, which are all part of the PSYOP. I mean, you know about Frank Zappa and the Laurel Canyon scene, and how he's from a military family, and he was, you know, all these people, everyone is an actor. Mm-hmm. They all have these designated roles, and Frank Zappa was this really wacky, crazy guy. But really, the whole Laurel Canyon scene was a CIA operation mm-hmm. to spread sex and drugs and rock and roll and corrupt the culture. Mm-hmm. I mean, not that I'm complaining about sex and drugs. I mean, I've benefited from it a bit, but nevertheless, now I'm older and wiser, I recognize what was going on.
Mm-hmm. I know Zappa himself was just weird. And I know that he didn't do any of that stuff. And he actually didn't even, and he wouldn't actually let anybody in the band because he was just personally, he's just too much of a perfectionist. Like, this is a guy I know, like people who used to be a sound engineer. I've heard stories about Zappa. Zappa could instinctively tell the difference between 111 and 112 beats per minute. Like, if you were off by that much, he would do a little dance in the control room and fire you. Like, this is the kind of, he was just that. And he was a truly insane man. But then, of course, he also ate corn sandwiches and got prostate cancer and didn't go to the freaking doctor and died of prostate cancer, of all things, because he was so, you know, frankly, up his own ass that he wouldn't even take care of himself. Like, and then dies at 52 or 53 or whatever. It's insane. I mean, Frank Zappa died. My dad threw a clot at 65 as a ex-NYPD who ate like he was an 8-year-old boy still starving in the depression, blah, 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 blah. You know, every marker imaginable for I'm going to die of a widowmaker at some point beyond 55, made it to 65, rolled the dice and dropped dead at a Knights of Columbus meeting one night. That was it. 3 minutes through a clot, he was gone. And still Zappa didn't, you know, could not last this guy. And this guy, like, literally treated himself like garbage from the time he, you know, he left military service, you know, after the Korean War. Like, you know,
have you developed a sort of corresponding health regimen in reaction to your dad?
No, not really. I just know that now, you know, I ate like type 2 diabetes was my mission in life until I was about 30. And I've got all the markers of having formerly had type 2 diabetes. And then we discovered that we should be eating meat and, you know, pretty much nothing else. And that's, you know, and now I just berate myself every time I have French fries and try to make sure that they're at least, you know, fried in tallow as opposed to soybean oil. But we do try and live up to the standard of, for the most part, carnivore, OMAD, if you can get away with it, intermittent fasting, because I smoke enough cigars that I want to enjoy my cigars, but I don't want to die at 55. So, and that's next month. So, you know, I'm moving on. Like, every year now is a gift. Ooh. Let's just put it that way.
I'm older than you, Tom. I can patronize you. You know, yes, young man, you're doing very well. But when you get to my age, you've got to understand, I've got this luxury problem at the moment, which is that I am desperately trying to put on weight. So when I have, you know, like in the afternoon, I might have a bowl of porridge and I'll pour loads of cream on it, or I'll slather loads of chunks of butter on my toast or whatever. And I know that even though my wife would want to be sort of looking at me going, don't you think you ought to have less? She can't, because she knows that I'm too skinny and I need to put on some weight.
Well, it's the porridge that'll make you fat, and it's the fat that will keep you healthy. Okay. Here's the key to gaining weight. Ready? This is the key to type 2 diabetes. You can eat protein and fat together, no problem. You can eat carbs and protein together, no problem. You cannot, if you want to put on weight, you eat fat and carbs. That's the signal to, that's where the body will dump the most insulin in, because you've got the fat to burn and now the carbs are completely superfluous and you'll put weight on. And this is where if you're doing it effectively, if you want it right, and you want to be careful about how you do this, but you can put weight on and it's not too hard. And then just do some strength training. You know, and when you do strength training, eat carbs and protein right afterwards in order to stimulate muscle growth. And if you manage the way you eat, and then only eat within like an 8 to 10 hour period during the day, so you can allow your body to rest and recuperate and be in a repair mode for about anywhere from more than 14 hours a day, then you'll be incredibly healthy. You'll be a lot healthier than it sounds like you actually are. I mean, my wife is 53, and when people meet her, they're shocked because she has the skin of a 35-year-old.
And, oh, I'd like that.
Yeah. And that's the big gig. And you can always, I can just like look at this, like when I look at a guy like Clarkson, I'm like, ugh. You know, I can just see it in the way in his complexion. Now, he's gotten actually better in the last couple of years. But James May, for example, looks like he's about to die.
He does.
He really looks terribly bad. And he's clearly drinking too much wine. And then just keep the alcohol, and the thing about this is keep your load off your liver as much as humanly possible. So anything that needs to be oxidized in the liver, caffeine, nicotine, You know, so I drink mostly decaf after my first pot of coffee in the morning. I have a small pot of coffee that's caffeinated. And after that, I just drink decaf with a little bit of chicory in it to give it some bite and make it so that it's not piss water. And then I just drink that for the rest of the day. And that's how I stay hydrated, because I love coffee and I pretty much hate everything else. So
yeah, but Tom, you can say all this shit and you can give me all this advice, but let's not forget, you're not as old as me, so you haven't got to where I am. I mean, so you're going to feel a right fool if you keel over like a couple of days before you reach the point where I am now, and you think you've been saying to yourself,
I've done enough damage to myself over the years, here and there, but I get my blood work done regularly, and I've been doing this now for on and off. You know, again, your goal is to always live up to your own aspirations. It's just like being an anarchist. Like, there's going to be times when you're going to be like, yep, nope. Like, I think the government, I think this government agency might have the right position, not on censorship, but on something else. You know, it's like every once in a while, like, it's like the argument we were making about the Fed when I was on your show a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, it's that kind of thing. It's like every once in a while, you got to, well, in order for me to get to where I would like society to go, I got to align myself with these guys temporarily. And then, you know, I'll feel dirty about it, but I'll get over myself. And that's that. And so you live up to your expectations. You live up to your principles as much as possible, but realize that, you know, none of us are perfect. And that's why we live in a fallen world. And that's what we're always constantly working for towards. And you got to have the right people to keep you on the straight and narrow.
Yeah. I'll go with that. Yeah. I of course, actually, the thing is about my weight is that horses quite like it when you're lighter.
Right.
And they're more eager to jump over a hedge. So
let's just put it this way. I would have to be on a draft horse. I'm still pretty heavy guy. I've put a few pounds on recently that I'm happy with. So I got to like be good about, I got to take about 3 months and, you know, pull 10, 15 pounds off. It's not that hard.
Do you watch Yellowstone?
No, I don't actually.
You like movies and stuff, but I quite like Yellowstone because it's got loads and loads of horses in it. And also, do you know the other thing I like about Yellowstone? Mm. It absolutely fucking hates the environmentalists.
Yeah.
And well, I think it was quite a good move from the guy, you know, the showrunner who did this, and he's had loads of other things, whatever his name is. But Yellowstone has been a massive hit.
Yes, and I've seen that.
And I thought it was quite a bold move, making one of the bad guys what you call Native American, for example, mm-hmm. and making the EPA the enemy, and making all these kind of park and wildlife people, you know, who want to arrest you for shooting a grizzly bear, for right. making them the bad guys. I think that's because I think we need to wake up to the fact, those of us who are not awake, that the environmental movement, the greenies generally, are among the most evil force in the world. They're certainly Satan's minions.
No, I agree. I didn't know that about Yellowstone. That's if it's a recommendation coming from you for something in pop culture that you could actually stomach, then that's high praise. Like that I'll put that on the list. And because generally speaking, like I don't know if you saw the on Amazon the Emily Blunt series, The English, was actually
I had to stop watching it. I could not cope. I tell you why. I watched the first. Are you about to tell me you liked it?
I loved it. I loved that story. I was actually so damn surprised that it wasn't everything wrong with. I was expecting white English woman goes to America, white man's burden, and then I have to listen to, you know, six episodes of white man's burden or seven, you know, six to eight episodes of white man's burden shit. And I was like, yeah, I'm not going there. And I didn't see that at all. What I saw was, you know, I really like that story, and I like the story between the two of them, and that's that. But again, I'm an American, and you know, and
yeah,
I don't have a lot good to say about the English at this point.
Okay, so what I hated about the English was number one, mm-hmm. that she's supposed to be a late 19th century aristocratic English woman,
right?
But she talked like she was coming out of a Hollywood therapy session in 2023.
Right.
Her conversations were with the Indian guy were not conversations. They were basically psychoanalysis sessions of just finding about his inner feelings and stuff, and then they fall in love. Couldn't bear all that. At first I was really excited because have you ever read a book by Cormac McCarthy called Blood Meridian?
I try to stay away from Cormac McCarthy, to be honest with you, because he is one of these guys that, like Dennis Lehane, and I just think that they've I'm too much of a class half full kind of guy for them. Like the bridge for me is those who are in effect postmodernists, but don't understand that postmodernism is a path to uncovering our humanity as opposed to just reinforcing, the bleakness of society and Marxism, like that, the undercurrent of like things like No Country for Old Men. And I can't do it. Like,
yeah,
give me Grant Morrison, give me Philip K. Dick every day of the week and twice on Sunday, and I'm staying away. And those guys I can't do, even though right. I agree, even though I can see the story and I'm like, yep, I watched No Country for Old Men once, and I'm like, great movie, done, never again. You know,
I didn't like the movie, and I know what you mean about the sort of nihilism that you find in Cormac McCarthy, It's more, I like him as a prose stylist. Like it as a sort of an apocalyptic visionary. I don't give a shit about his green politics. If those are his politics, I can't really work out what he thinks. I mean, I think
I have a hard time with nihilists. I really do. Because I see nihilism as just another, it's just another fucking psyop for friggin' Marxism. Like I see nihilism as, and I just have no patience for it. So I'm very sensitive.
I'm not retracting my position. I'm just kind of understanding where you are on McCarthy. But you're right. I'm reading this delightful book at the moment, which I don't know whether you've ever come across, by a Russian writer called Ivan Goncharov, called Oblomov. Mm-hmm. Oblomov this book was rated by Chekhov and Tolstoy, but both of them wrote, you know, I wish I could have written this book. This guy is genius. And it's about this member of the Russian landed gentry in the kind of late 19th century, and he just sits around on his ass doing nothing, mm-hmm. and just being sensitive to nature and to feelings and stuff like this. Anyway, it does develop into a plot after a time, but it's a lovely book. But reading this book, in fact, I've been really into reading the Russians recently. I've been reading quite a bit of Dostoevsky. I haven't read Anna Karenina yet, but I've read Tolstoy and I've read Turgenev, and I'm about to move on to Dead Souls after this. And reading this stuff, and I think you'll identify with this, you realize what an incredibly cultured place Russia was in the 19th century. This was a truly great civilization, which for my money, produced the best literature, certainly in the field of novels. You know, they urinate from a great height all over Dickens. They're even better than the French, who I'd say generally better than us. You know, Flaubert and Balzac, I think, I prefer to Dickens. I mean, I quite like Austen. But when you read the Russians, you are just filled with awe at the culture that could have produced this stuff. And that culture was completely wiped out by the Bolsheviks, completely. And it's really, really frightening. You know, we look at Rome and think the glory that was Rome and how that was wiped out according to the official narrative anyway, by the barbarians, but you know, by Alaric and whatever, and all these Goths, you know, all these people in the Teutoburg forest and stuff. And we're meant to sort of half lament the fall of this great civilization. But in our own, almost within living memory. In fact, there are probably still people alive who remember the Soviet horrors. This entire class, entire culture was destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
We know who really funded the right. Bolshevik Revolution. It was, you know, your Wall Street guys.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Sorry, central bankers. I mean, not Wall Street.
Well, both. But yeah, I mean, a mix of European and American banking interests.
Yeah, yeah. It's horrific when you realize that, did we talk about this one? I can't remember. Another of my pet bugbears. The things, do you know what? I mean, this is almost actually exceeds the rage that's introduced by lights on in hotel rooms. And the phrase that you hear trotted out again and again about man's inhumanity to man. This is just bollocks.
Yes.
This is justification for the evil in the world that is done by a tiny, tiny minority. When you know that the French Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution, World War I, World War II, the Vietnam War, The Korean War, name every war.
And soon to be the war in Ukraine.
The war in Ukraine.
Mascale.
They were organized by the same people as part of their business stroke rape cycle. I think that most people, and you and I are sort of typical of this, we just want to be left alone, to live with our families, to give our children a better life, to cultivate our gardens, to grow apple trees, to maybe have beehives, make honey. This is the natural state of man. Yes. Man is not naturally a kind of warlike thing. He has to be pushed into war by the rulers of the darkness of this world.
Man is not a virus, Agent Smith. I'm sorry, you're wrong. And yes, like, you know, it's just that simple. And the Marxists really do see us as a virus. I'll give you the phrase that bothers the fucking holy fuck out of me. Ready?
Yeah.
And we'll find out what that phrase is when we come back. But we're going to take a little bit of a break. And it's time to get back to the second half of the conversation between myself and James Dellingpole, wherein I'm going to tell him what it is, the phrase that bothers me more than man's inhumanity to man. One final note before I get back to the podcast, James was having a little bit of a problem with his mic, and it really started to show up here and there in the second half of the podcast. He was really trying hard to, you know, keep his connection solid. So if there's a variability in his audio, it's purely a technical thing on his end. I did my best to clean it up. So back to the show. I'll give you the phrase that bothers the fucking holy fuck out of me. Ready?
Yeah.
Man-made. As an antipode, by implication, to the natural world. Like, I don't know about you, but the last time I checked, we're part of the system that is the Earth.
Mm.
The Earth created men. Created man. It created all of this stuff. Like, you can't worship fucking Gaia and not worship humanity.
Mm.
Like, this is why I truly think I hold the environmental movement in contempt, because they have mixed their hatred of humanity with their hatred of pollution. That we've forgotten that environmentalism was supposed to be about cleaning up the pollution so that we could live in without shit in our rivers and without disease and dysentery and all the things. And, you know, and they turned it into a political thing in order to turn it into a control mechanism for a bunch of fucking shitbag nihilists.
Yeah.
Who rejected God, who rejected even the conception of God as a metaphor. This is what really pisses me off. And then these people call themselves fucking scientists. And I have to sit here and listen to Neil deGrasse Tyson condescend me, man, about he knows what science is and I don't. Fuck you. Like, it's complete fucking horse shit. You have destroyed. I mean, dude, like, I know scientists who are like, you get to the end of physics where Neil deGrasse Tyson is supposed to be. And you're like, it's all fucking faith, dude. We don't have a fucking clue as to what's going on. And high energy physicist first, political commentator and philosopher second. Like, I came at this the other way. Like, that's where I started as a mathematician and an Aspie guy studying chemistry and literally high energy physics, like studying rare gas metal clusters in the gas phase. Okay. That lasted 50 microseconds before we blew them apart with a fucking laser. This is the shit I did as an undergraduate. Hey, this is my intellectual background. And we used to laugh at an analytic chemist going, what do? They integrate area under the curve. They're not even scientists. Okay.
Yeah.
These are the people I hung out with.
Yeah. 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 Have you ever done a podcast with Will Happer?
No, I haven't.
Oh, Will Happer's he's a great guy. You know, he's complete climate change skeptic. You know, a brilliant Princeton.
I did one with the first time I sat down with Dave Collum. We the two of us went together. The two chemists just went like we went off on these people. Like, it was fun.
Will Happer says that if it has the name science in its title, it's not a science. So you know, you've got physics, chemistry. Well, they're sciences, but
right.
In environmental science. Definitely not a science. The social sciences aren't sciences.
Not
aren't
sciences. Science. Political science. I used to. An age ago when I used to be a chemist. I was riffing off of Jared Manley Hopkins and Sprung Rhythm and all this shit. And I said, you know, and the odd, very odd political scientists, because like they're not scientists. And I was like ripping off of, you know, I was riffing off of the physics of state changes and, you know, as winter turns into spring and all this stuff. And I'm like, and the odd, very odd political scientist is wondering about blah. I'm like, I can't, he's not even qualified for it because he's not even a scientist. So, you know.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. I agree with you completely.
I lost my train of thought. I was thinking about the whole Will Happer thing and about the what you were saying earlier about where did it all go wrong? I mean, you can pick almost any century and argue that this was the beginning of the end. So the whole of the Enlightenment, I think, was actually the Endarkenment. We've been sold this line that actually what this did was it replaced replaced religion with this thing, science, and suddenly we had a much better handle on the nature of the universe and stuff. No, it wasn't. It was designed above all to kill God and replace God with these charlatans, actually, in many cases. I mean, even the good ones were often enthralled to this kind of Luciferian agenda where they wanted to place.
It's funny, you know, we talk about, you know, what you've been reading recently. One of my favorite writers, I invoke Philip K. Dick all the time. I invoke Kafka and Borges and those guys. But one of my favorite writers I don't talk about a lot is Stephen Donaldson, the great American fantasy writer, wrote Thomas Covenant and a variety of other things. His last series, this is an old, you want to talk about an old curmudgeon. A man who's sold millions of books and everything else and has had Hollywood beating at his door for decades to adapt his books into movies. And he's like, no, absolutely not. Fuck you people. You suck. His latest series is it's classic that he's thinking about this, preparations, 20-year preparation by the last repository of knowledge in the world. So basically the Library of Alexandria, against a religious cult that's basically evil Christianity, like Christianity that's been subsumed by and turned into a rapacious thing. One of the things I meant to, you know, to follow up on is that, again, it's like Marxists believe that man is a virus and that we will spread into all of these areas. This is Club of Rome shit. Like they talk about this.
The stuff. Earth has a cancer. The cancer is man.
The cancer is man. And if we don't stop, and if we give man access to cheap, abundant energy, he's going to destroy the entire world. And so we have to stop him. And this is Julian Huxley and UNESCO. This is the Club of Rome shit. This is all this stuff going back to the 40s, 50s, or whatever. So like, I get all that. And so it's clear that that's what we're dealing with. And that, you know, we have a phrase internally between myself and Dexter, Common Turn never ended. It just went underground. And that Uncle Joe, meaning Uncle Joe McCarthy, was right. He may have been a drunk, but he was right. There were commies everywhere. There still are. They're everywhere. And a lot of them don't even realize it anymore. It's just this shit's on autopilot in many ways. Many, a lot of it, if you're being generous. So I just find it fascinating that a guy like Donaldson, whose first book was about a leper rapist who has to save the world, because God speaks through the most, that he speaks through the worst of us.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a very powerful, that's why that story is so powerful. And, you know, and it's the same, but here we are, the same thing at the end of the day. And, you know, and at the end of his career, he's telling us the exact same thing. And this, you know, as people like Jordan Peterson and others, they, you know, artists always get there first. So 10 years ago, when he was plotting this story out, it was clear where he saw where we were going, in the same way that, you know, we see it, the true artists within our society. And there are a few of them who have made the deal with the devil to be popular enough that they can actually produce work that can push through the counter programming. I think Chris Nolan, for example, is a perfect example of this kind of person who knows how to play the game just well enough to get through, build, and then build the story, but then tell the right story. And I think he's done that more often than not in his career. It's not always right, but he's done it pretty well. And this is just the kind of thing, because there's still the opportunity to tell great stories, because the public will always eat them up when they're real, when they're true. I say this about Marxists all the time. The classic example for me is Alan Moore's Watchmen. Alan Moore, being a left anarchist, kind of classic Marxist, yada, 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 you know, builds this entire Marxian, you know, world about the, you know, then deconstructing the superhero myth and everything else that is Watchmen. And it's brilliantly conceived and all of this stuff, but it's ultimately just a Hobbesian dialectic, you know, A and B will fight until the death unless S, the Superman, the state, comes in and keeps them at bay. And the minute they remove Dr. Manhattan from the scene, then the Russians and the United States want to get to nuclear war. That's the text of Watchmen with everything else happening. At the end of the day, though, as much as Alan Moore fucking hates libertarians and objectivists and all the and all these humanists, guess what? His best character and the one we all responded to was Rorschach. And Rorschach is humanity's unwillingness to be frog marched into technocratic socialist hell.
Yeah.
Is willing to die for his beliefs.
I'll tell you who gets away with murder as well. Are you familiar with Mark Miller? Comic books. So Kingsman. I mean, Kingsman was a fantastic assault on the environmental movement, a fantastic riposte to all this kind of, oh, Thanos, isn't he great? Mm-hmm.
Thanos rhymes with Davos, by the way.
There was a Doctor Who villain called Davros at one stage. He was half human when he was like had a Dalek bottom. Did you ever watch?
No, I never watched it. No, I never saw any of this. I stopped my comic book collecting around, I don't know, about 2000, 2001 or so. I just got kind of silly, but yeah. But go ahead.
But mostly, I think sci-fi is just is revelation of the method and predictive programming. It's there to sort of tell us the shit that's coming down the line and get us to accept it in advance. I mean, look at so we all quote the Matrix,
right?
But look at what's happened to the Wachowski brothers or the Wachowski sisters, as they now are.
Right.
I mean,
But sometimes, you know, it's funny. Like I understand that, but part of me always says, you know, the artist, after they've created the art, it's not theirs anymore. George Lucas found this out, like really found this out when he made the prequel films. They're not his anymore. And I think the same thing with The Matrix. The Wachowski sisters tried to claw it back with those two awful sequels. And then the last one, which was, I mean, as a movie, it wasn't uniquely terrible like the second two were. It was almost watchable for two acts. I think that it's like Hemingway, right? I always go back to my ninth grade honors English class, and we're doing The Old Man and the Sea, and I get the story about how Hemingway was interviewed and said, you know, when you wrote the book, did you intend for the old man to become a Christ-like figure as he's carrying his mast down the dock of what's left of his ship, down the dock and up the hill to his home at the, you know, to Golgotha? And he's like, no, man, I just wrote the book. Like, yeah. You know what I mean? And so I think artists work at a very unconscious level. The best art is always created at an unconscious level. And, you know, I'll be honest with you. I don't think Alan Moore understood that he wrote Rorschach as an indictment of everything that is, quote unquote, the individual movement. As a pastiche of Steve Ditko's The Question, and it turns into like, oh, by the way, that's what we respond to. Not all these other characters. All these other characters suck. Rorschach is the person we all wish we could be at a certain level. Not, you know, the violent psychopath that he actually was, but the core of who he was as a person, and to be that incorruptible. We would all like to be that.
I sympathize with your point, and yet I suspect that I'm even further down the rabbit hole in this than you are, in as much as that I've reached the point where I do not trust anyone. I mean, okay, so take Brave New World.
Right.
Aldous Huxley, I used to think, yeah, way to go. Aldous is our man. He predicted this technocratic future. Well, right. As you know, his brother was Julian. He was in balls deep in the technocratic agenda. You know, in its first incarnation in the 1930s, Aldous was just merely telling us what his mates were planning and what he himself probably agreed with. I mean, J.K. Rowling.
Just because he intended to do that doesn't mean that we have to accept the art that way. That's the wonderful, beautiful thing about art, ultimately.
Yeah. Okay. You know, I take that little bit of hopium.
Fair enough. I have to have.
But, Well, look, when you realize that Shakespeare was part of the PSYOP, that right. Shakespeare was not written by a man from Stratford-upon-Avon with small Latin and less Greek, you know, not by a sort of a super bright grammar school boy. Right. He was written by the Earl of Oxford, Edward de Vere, mm-hmm. with a scriptorium being like a bit like one of those sort of writing tables that put together the Simpsons and Friends.
Right.
Where
it's a writer's room.
Yeah, writer's room, exactly. So Edward de Vere assembled the best playwrights of his day, put them on the books, and they wrote the works of Shakespeare. And everyone knew this at the time. Everyone knew this for probably, or anyone educated knew this for at least 200 years after its death. It's only recently that we've come to revere the Bard from Avon as this fictional character. So once you realize that the greatest writer in the canon of at least modern Western literature, I mean, we can, Homer was part of the PSYOP as well, that once you realize that the greatest writer was himself, well, I mean, I'm sure there were political motives for doing this stuff. I mean, they were propping up the Tudors, weren't they? They were propping mm-hmm. up the Elizabeth. They were writing political propaganda. So if even Shakespeare is not tainted, then who escapes? I now suspect that they will not allow you to be really successful unless you are doing what they want. Harry Potter being the most obvious example of that. You know, the Harry Potter was written actually to promote in the minds of young children, wizards, black magic, and a sort of a godless universe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny. I understand that, and I don't even disagree with a lot of that. I also happen to think that, and I've mentioned this before, young adult fiction is the most important part. It's the most culturally relevant fiction to be written because it's written and targeted for the people who are most open to a transformative experience by art and literature. The stories we ingest as teenagers, the music we listen to, the movies we watch, all of this stuff, these are the things that kind of make us who we are. So I can go through all the things that I, you know, the first serious book I ever read was Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick. Like I went from reading nothing, like reading Dr. Seuss, to not reading, to reading Philip K. Dick. That's where I started. And, you know, the novelization of Star Wars. Like that's where that was it for me. Right. So, and then it just went on from there. And then but that was me. And maybe that makes me, you know, a Three Sigma, you know, anomaly. Right. But what I came to realize was that things like when I look back on Harry Potter, why it's so important, why something like Star Wars, why Harry Potter, why the Hunger Games, for example, such a powerful.
Oh, we know why. We know why. Because she comes from Norfolk, Virginia.
Right.
I mean, she's well, this is like thinly veiled reality. Right. She's describing the world she comes from. Right. I mean, whether she's on board with us or whether she's just, again, it's predictive programming and conditioning and stuff.
I'm not talking about Jennifer Lawrence. I'm talking about the story of the Hunger Games. Like the story of the Hunger Games gets out into the world and becomes this viral, massive thing because it is ahead of its time and it's effectively metaphorically true. And we're living through the Hunger Games today. And they're prepping us for the Hunger Games in the future, but we already have the cautionary tale. So now the question is it a soporific or is it a call to action? Is the big question. And I don't have an answer for that, but I know that without it, we don't have even the opportunity for it to be a call to action that's relevant to the world we live in today. Because that's what the stories are. Stories are there, are the lessons that we tell generation to generation in order to deal with the issues of the day. So Homer wrote about his things in order to educate. That's what the Bible is. It's just at its worst, at its least generous. The Bible is a compendium of all these great stories in order to help us navigate when we're confronted with a whole bunch of Satanists trying to destroy us and destroying society. And what are we going to, and how are we going to respond to them in the next iteration of all this?
Well, it's interesting. I was about to say, you know, the Bible is one of the few
texts that you can rely on. But actually, can you? I mean, I read a fascinating book about the making of the King James Bible, which sure. is the one I use and the one that I think a lot of Americans use as well. Thank God, because I mean, it's worked wonders for our language. It's given us so many phrases, and it's given us this sort of, apparently the language that in which the King James Bible was written was archaic and unrealistic, even when it was written, even when they put it together. They deliberately affected this sort of archaic diction. They were looking back to the previous century. And actually, to be fair, a lot of the good bits, a lot of the best bits of the King James Bible were written in the 16th century rather than the 17th century by people like Miles Coverdale, whose version of the Psalms I think are often better than the ones in the King James. But anyway, the point I was trying to make was that this was a political translation as much as a scholarly one. It was commissioned right. by King James, who was a high level Freemason. I'm not even convinced that all the kings and queens of England, just like the monarchs of Europe, are not basically Satanists anyway. Their Christianity is just a kind of nominal thing, because people don't like to be ruled by Satanists. But that's by the by. So when he commissions this translation of the Bible, well, he's not gonna major on passages which question the role of the importance of kings, for example. So there are all these tweaks. So then you ask, where do I go back to? I mean, do I go back to the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew, carried out by I think 70 scholars of the day? Or can you trust the Latin version? Well, so it's a hall of mirrors, the whole thing.
Of course. No, it's really funny. Like, as I'm listening to you speak, it's just really funny. Like, one of my favorite writers, Mark Millar's early writing partner is Grant Morrison, and wrote The Invisibles. I don't know if you've ever, like, you talk about like one of the greatest comics ever written. And it's literally literally about birthing up the new world and setting and all the conspiracy theories of all time, all true, and all the rest of this stuff, and the secret societies, and there's them secret societies fighting the secret societies. And of course the British crown is a bunch of Satanists right in the middle of it, and it's just hilarious. And, but knowing also that Grant Morrison is a chaos magician and writes things down as a kind of sigil in order to put out into the world to change the world for the better. And he intentionally believes that. I go back now and I read every one of his comics and I'm like, is this his massive thing, be it the Invisibles or Doom Patrol or his run on JLA or Batman or whatever. I'm like, oh, what was his intention there? And again, the artist is as part of the process as vector for this stuff. I think as vehicle for these things. I think it's just a fascinating thing to explore. And there's no question here, James, that we're living through an inflection point in history. And, the good question is now is, where are we going to wind up? Are we going to wind up, just another iteration down the Satanist rabbit hole? Or is this going to be where the whole thing kind of blows up, we reset a bit, and we're birthed into a new world and a different world? One that's not run by the Western system of control, and that's a good question.
Well, this is why Bible scholars are at a premium right now, because right. I mean, and they're all, we need them to explain what Revelation is really about, and there seem to be these various conflicting theories, don't they? I mean, like the whole concept of the rapture. I think it'd be great, if people like me, were assumed into heaven in with beams of light or whatever. I don't think it's going to happen. I'm not of that particular.
Oh, neither am I. I think it's all metaphor for me. I always take all these things as metaphors. Like, what are we going to do with this, and what society are we going to build afterwards? That's what all these stories are really truly about. I'm not practicing Christian. I grew up Catholic. I'm not at all. But my spirituality is like, I just know that the world is weird enough that I don't have a fucking clue as to how it actually operates, and I'm open to any and all interpretation. So I'll listen to the Flat Earthers. I listen to the people, the Christians who believe the Earth is 4,000 years old. I listen to everybody. I don't know. I don't care. What I care is, what are your intentions with that information in terms of how it interfaces with the society you and I are going to build? Because that's all I can really care. That's all I can affect. And then, and we come to some negotiated settlement ultimately.
Well, I think you and I probably both that what we're in World War III at the moment,
yes,
and it started some time ago.
Absolutely,
and this is an information war. So you and I and people like us are on the front lines. You know, we don't need to charge machine gun posts anymore with our, you know, with our M50s blazing,
or M14s and or M1 Garands or the greatest gun ever, or the most gun that subjugated more brown people than anything else in the world, the Enfield. 303 British.
Yeah.
I own a brilliant version of, and I keep for exactly that reason, just to remind myself. It's also a tack driver, by the way.
It's the coldest I've ever been. I went and joined a bunch of military reenactors at Bastogne in the winter. And we did all these night maneuvers, and I had my M1 Garand, and all the original kit, so not really adequate to the task of keeping you warm.
Right.
And marching with that rifle, the hand that is holding the butt of the rifle to keep it steady, the fingers get so cold, but it was really good. There was a moment where we went into this cafe, and there was a veteran of Bastogne there.
Wow.
Who? Because some people are. There's a weird thing in America which I think is really wrong, where they talk about stolen valor. I mean, I think military reenactment is a perfectly credible activity. You're not pretending to be an actual soldier. You are just kind of paying. We went through it for real, and this old veteran said to us, "Thank you for doing this thing." He was really glad that people still cared, that people were able to engage imaginatively with what he and his boys went through for real.
It's like cultural appropriation. It's the same kind of thing to say stolen valor is no different than cultural appropriation. It's like, you want to understand somebody else. Why wouldn't you want to put on their clothes or eat their food or anything along those lines? This is the whole point of culture. It's the whole point of building anything so that we can get to understand other people, so that, oh my God, we don't see them as the other, and we don't want to go to war with them. So it's the same thing, like, you know, reenactments, people LARPing at medieval fairs, whatever they're doing. Like, dude, I did a lot of role playing in my life, you know, tabletop RPGing. And part of what you're doing there is, you know, live action storytelling. And it's why we all love sports. I've been saying this for years. I'm like, professional sports is one of the last opportunities for spontaneous on the fly storytelling. If you understand, that's what a sporting event is, and that's
when it's all rigged.
Well, regardless of any of the spectacle at all, but it's the romance that it's not, that's still, that's what drives us to show up. And of course, you know, it's why I don't watch the NFL anymore. It's why I've never watched basketball. You know, I have a hard time even with hockey. With the NHL, knowing full well, though, that hockey is such a freaking brutal sport and such a random sport that at a certain level, you know, they can only put their thumb on the scale on a hockey. The referees can only put their thumb on the scale of the game so far in a hockey match, and it's still just sheer will of the guys who are the not supposed to win can still overcome, and you can see it. I haven't, I say that having not watched the NHL regularly for 6 or 7 years now, but it's the only sport that, you know, ever held my attention after I understood what was going on. And probably still, in my mind, the best example of on-the-fly storytelling where you can't look away, because everywhere on the pitch, on the playing field, the ice surface is dangerous. And every interaction is dangerous. And every one-on-one interaction is dangerous. And every opportunity for people to fail. And so that's what I find fascinating about that. And yeah, we would like some honesty in it. We'd like some honesty in something. In this fucking world, I'll take honesty in anything at this point. Because we live in such a dishonest world. I want honesty in money or politics or, you know, storytelling or sports or, you know, I'll take anything. I'll take it at
all.
Take it anywhere, you know. Give me a local council meeting. Give me a local friggin', you know, county commission meeting where my fucking county commissioners aren't lying through their fucking teeth at me.
Yeah, that's going to happen.
Yeah, I know exactly.
Yeah, but the thing is, I think, like, although we wouldn't necessarily have chosen to live in these times, although actually probably we would, because what people say, isn't it, that we've all chosen this moment to live, you know, for some reason, right. If you believe that. One of the good things about what's happening now is that people are waking up to what really matters. Yes. And what really matters is stuff like family, nature, the immutable, the God-given things, actually, yes. The things that love, friendship, these are the things that endure, and everything else is just illusion and vanity.
Yes.
And I think when you keep sight of those things, actually, one can be quite optimistic, because this has been a great awakening. People realize that what we're experiencing now is something that has been planned over generations by an evil, I'm not going to call them elite, because that sounds like they're special or they have special talents. They don't. They're just scum. They're evil scum. Mm-hmm. And we are wise to their game now, which we weren't in history, most of us.
We never were. I called them cantillionaire midwits over the weekend. And the cantillion effect is those who are closest to the creation of new money get to spend it at yesterday's prices and get the benefit of it. So they're all cantillionaires. These are all people born on third base who thought they hit triples, and they're not very smart, and they have no idea. And because of this, you know, they wield power, and power doesn't make you smart. Power makes you dumb, because you wield it indiscriminately because you've got it and you never work to earn it. And so therefore, so you look at people like Klaus Schwab, who didn't earn his power. He was handed that power.
Mm.
You look at somebody like George Soros, and he's a different case, because he actually earned his power by stealing from other people. And, he stole from people. But you look at a lot of these people, you look at you look at Meghan Markle and Harry, and you look at the British Crown, and you look at, you know, the people who run the European Union, and you look at all these people, and they were all handed their power. You know,
all the people that were sold as heroes, Winston Churchill.
Exactly.
Churchill.
Sorry.
I've just got a podcast with a historian who's given me us on the dark truth about Winston Churchill.
Yeah.
And it's way worse than you think.
I can only imagine. And
a pedophile, murderer, you know.
Like, I've always I've always looked at Churchill very skeptically, and the older I get, I look at it every day. I'm like, oh, so I'm not surprised to hear that he was any allocation against, you know, Churchill's memory, probably true. I'm not going to say one way or the other, but if it is, great. If it's not, it's not. I don't really care. But at this point, the man had every opportunity to avoid World War II and threw us into it completely, like, period. And for no goddamn good reason other than, you know, some grand plan of somebody that, you know, somebody else. And it doesn't really matter what the specifics of that grand plan were. It was just some grand plan of a bunch of people who thought they ruled the world and had the right to rule the world. Fuck you. You don't have the right to rule shit.
There's a line in one of the Psalms, a famous line, mm-hmm. Put not your trust in princes. I mean, you know, the Bible, yet again, absolutely right. One shouldn't look up to these people, because they have been selected for these roles, and they are roles. They're just acting roles, and they're there by dint of their birth, not by dint of their talent. They're just put there. And
here in the U.S., they are recruited based on their by their personality faults.
Oh, yes, they select for psychopathy. Absolutely. Yeah, no,
they are absolutely selected. So Bill Gates was selected. Like, all of them were selected. Like, it's very clear. You know, Al Gore was selected. Hillary Clinton was selected. They were all selected.
Elon Musk,
yeah, of course. So none of these people are heroes to me. They're all used for in a particular role. Sometimes they get out of, they go off script, and, you know, we see a little bit of, and then it's like the old Robin Williams skit about Reagan being an animatronic. It moved him too far, pull him back, you know, that kind of thing. And those things that, like, a line by that, like that from a throwaway gag by Robin Williams and a freaking HBO stand-up routine 35 or 40 years ago is stuck with me to this day, and I see it everywhere. And, you know, every once in a while, Trump got out, you know, did the wrong thing, or did the thing that the one faction didn't like. So they went nuts. And it, while he was serving a different faction and blah, blah, it's all bullshit. It's, you know, and the big question now is, and this is what I was trying to explain to you the other day, and I think I was reasonably successful at it, which is that now they can all see that we can see them for the first time, and now they're starting to fight amongst themselves as to who's going to be in charge. And the Russians, the Chinese, and the global majority, as Peter Lavelle over at RT put it to me the other day, they're sitting back with popcorn and going, "Huh, that's kind of fun. This is what we're going to do." So yeah. This is going to be so have fun, guys. You do not rule shit, but you still have a bunch of lieutenants running around. Some of the colonels are getting thrown under the bus, and the generals are very nervous. And for the first time, I think in a long, long time, they're very nervous.
Maybe it's for the first time ever.
Right. Maybe.
They've had it all their way for so long.
Yes, they really have. I mean, old English, old European colonialism and its downstream attendant effects, like, you know, having infected the United States and infected other areas of the world, is in serious, serious trouble today. And it's a good thing. And it's because of people like you, hopefully people like myself and others who've just finally broken through enough, and the technology that they gave us that they thought they were going to enslave us with, and we've now turned it against them.
Yeah. Amen. Let's hope.
Yeah, let's hope. That's the best we can do. And if not, well, then attend to your local community, attend to the love and family and all the things you can do to make things as tight, to make as tight a knit circle around you as possible. A little practical anarchy never hurt nobody.
Well, I'm sorted. If it all goes wrong, I've got God. I mean, you know, that's you know, as a Christian, yep. you do have that resource.
Again,
ultimately, he wins.
And that, which is, and for those, and I agree with you. And for those who are secular in the audience, or reasonably secular, you just say, look, it's your willingness to submit to the will of the universe in some way that it'll all work out as long as you remain open to it working out and staying in the moment and staying true to the whatever thing it is that you want without having to put your trust in heroes and understand where the breakpoints are.
Bring all you mentioned the key Marshall. Word, yeah. True. Truth has to be our watchword.
Exactly.
If you stick to the truth, because we've all got moral compasses, we all know what the truth is.
Right.
You won't go wrong. Right. The truth is really important, because this is the realm of the Prince of Lies, whether you choose to take that literally or metaphorically.
Of course.
Everything that's going on in the world today is a liar. The politicians are liars. The entertainment industry is a promulgation of lies. The media, my goodness, that's about telling lies. We're lied to about the vaccines. We're lied to about agriculture. We're lied to about the health benefits or otherwise of meat and eating vegetables. And everything is a lie.
That's right. Plants don't want to be eaten. It's really simple. This is how I cure people of not being carnivores. Plants don't want to be eaten. Go look at everything about a plant chemically, and you'll realize that plants have done everything imaginable to make themselves unpalatable to carnivores. That's why herbivores have three stomachs and take 3 days and have to literally are nothing but bacteria factories. They are literally nothing but beer factories to get something out of them. And even then, those animals, I raise goats, are in ketosis, not glucosis, folks. Like, they're extracting the protein. They're burning ketones, because it's not an efficient process.
What's that? I haven't had my lunch yet, and I'm thinking I need some meat. I need meat.
We found some meat. This is a line from the Book of Eli, which is a great, by the way, which is one of those few lovely, I think, bits of popular entertainment in the last 10 years is actually really worth people's time. Book of Eli was an uncommonly good little movie with Denzel Washington.
Okay.
You've not seen it? You should know. Yeah. Take your time this afternoon. Watch the Book of Eli with Denzel as a blind warrior in a benighted world. I think you of all people will really appreciate it.
Okay. Ooh, thanks for the tip.
Absolutely. All right. I think we'll leave it there then. Do you have anything else you want to say on your way out the door?
I think we should save it for the next time we have another chat. I think why not? We've got a good thing going.
I will. I'll give you a ring in a little while, and we'll do the thing.
Yeah, that'll be good. Okay, thank you. And will you tell people where they can find my podcast and stuff, or what it's called?
Actually, why don't you do that? Because I'm not really quite sure. You did that.
Okay. So if you so happen to have liked this show, I'm sure you did. I do a podcast, and it's called The Delling Pod, which is spelled D-E-L-I-N-G POD, Delling Pod. It's on all the usual places, and you know, you can support me on Substack and Subscribestar and Patreon and Locals, but you'll find it on all the channels, and it's great. It's really good. I you know, I'm biased, but it is great.
He had me on it. Of course it's great.
Yeah, exactly.
So and with that, the Mutual Appreciation Society will come to an end. And we'll talk again soon. Thank you very much for your time, James. I really appreciate
it. Thanks a lot, Tom.
Bye-bye. Well, that'll about wrap it up for episode 128 of the Gold, Goats, and Guns podcast. Thank you for joining me for that journey through the mind of me and James Dellingpole. Actually, it was a very interesting conversation. I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed James as a person. This is two conversations I've had with him in the last month, and they've just been, you know, an absolute blast. So I don't know whether it was fun for you, but I know it was fun for me. And at the end of the day, it's really kind of what this is all about. I hope you enjoyed it. So as always, you can follow me and my work over at the blog at tomluongo.me. You can follow me on Twitter at TFL1728, where the worst version of me exists on the internet. And of course, you can sign up for the Patreon at patreon.com/goldgoatsandguns and sign up for the newsletter and the private community server and my private blog posts and market reports and all the other things that I do. So we'll be back soon. It's going to be another interesting, I think the next episode I have teed up is another cultural one. So it should be fun and hopefully out in a few days. So you guys be well. You take care. We'll talk soon. Keep your stick on the ice.